I'm Jonathan Capehart in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. China and India are the two emerging superpowers of the 21st century. Both have enormous populations, fast-growing economies, and even larger appetite for new resources. In the middle of all this is Burma. Although long considered a backwater and a pariah in the West, Burma is now positioned in one of the most strategic places on Earth. Joining us now is Thant Mit Nhu. His book is called Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello, Thant. I want to apologize for mispronouncing your name all day today until you corrected me. It's pronounced Thant, so
thank you.
I want to apologize for that. Thant, Burma has a number of major problems, as you know. It has an impoverished population. It's ruled by a paranoid military dictatorship that has isolated it politically and economically. The country also has some of the world's longest-running ethnic conflicts, but I get the sense that you, along with the Chinese and Indian governments, also see it as a place with tremendous potential?
It is a place with tremendous potential, and it always has been in a way. I mean, there's huge mineral resources, there's huge potential in agriculture. It's potentially very rich in oil and gas. And more than anything else, it's a strategic location between the world's two biggest rising economies. For China, it's both a potential access point to India, but more importantly, it's a potential bridge to the Indian Ocean as well.
Now, you describe Burma as, quote, the missing link. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think of Asian geography, if you look at the map, and I guess my book in a way was trying to get people to look at the map of Asia in a different way, Asia has always been divided between its two biggest, greatest civilizations, India and China. And if you think of India and China, they're entirely different ethnically in terms of culture and other ways. And it's been divided because you have the Himalayas and you also have Burma, which is a very mountainous, isolated place that was very difficult to cross for thousands of years. So this basic fact of Asian geography has always been that India and China have grown up separately, partly because of Burma. And it's this that's changing. Burma is going from becoming a barrier in a way to becoming a crossroads or a link between these two countries.
Now, you mentioned this before, but the Chinese are working on a link through Burma to the Indian Ocean. What kinds of things are they building? Highways, pipelines, ports, all of the above?
All of the above. It's actually phenomenal in many ways. I mean, not just in a Burmese context, but in any context. I mean, the highways have been built. The Chinese have just started building a $23 billion high-speed rail that will ultimately connect Rangoon to Beijing and ultimately to Europe as well.
Right.
There are huge oil and gas pipelines being built, a deep sea port. So it's infrastructure. But more than that, there's a huge movement of people. 2 million Chinese have moved into Burma over the past 15 years. Cities in the north of Burma have become majority Chinese places. Places that were completely distant from China 10, 20 years ago, generation ago, you know, have kids who are learning Chinese. So it's not like the Chinese presence in other parts of the world, say, you know, where they're expanding economic ties in parts of Africa.
Right.
Here there's a cultural frontier moving as well.
Now, you know that Chinese academics have written about a two oceans policy. What does that mean and why is it important?
It's two different things. The Chinese see two huge problems at the most strategic grand level. One is that they have a relatively rich east coast. Beijing, Shanghai, Guangdong are all relatively rich places. The interior of China, the west of China, is relatively extremely, extremely poor. And they want a link for that part of China to the ocean. Secondly, more than 80% of China's imported oil now comes through the Straits of Malacca and around Singapore. And the Chinese fear that in the future, in a future conflict with the United States or with India, the Straits of Malacca are only a couple of miles wide at its narrowest point, that could be a choke point for China's energy. And so they want another way in which energy can be brought, oil essentially from the Middle East and Africa, can be brought into China. So Burma, if Burma becomes a bridge for China to the Indian Ocean, if Burma becomes essentially the California of China, a second coast, it will both, the Chinese hope, solve this problem of its poor West being relatively isolated, but through these pipelines will also provide an alternative energy route into China from the rest of the world.
What are the environmental costs in Burma to all of this development?
It's enormous, and it's very controversial because The pipelines, not so much, but the Chinese are also investing literally billions of dollars, perhaps over $10 billion, in massive hydroelectric power projects. Burma has huge rivers that are running down from the Himalayas to the sea. And the Chinese, and these are some of the only rivers left in the world that are not dammed, and the Chinese are damming them up right now, at great cost to some of the local communities and at great cost to the natural environment as well. So there is the plus in the sense that a lot of people in China will have electricity and some people in Burma will have more electricity. But again, it's a great cost, at least to the environment as well as to people in that region.
Mm-hmm. So we spent the first part of this talking all about Burma and its relation, China and its involvement and relationship with Burma. But now, look, there's someone on the other side, and that's India. The Indians have adopted, as you say, a look east policy. How are they engaging with Burma?
Well, the Indians used to be very supportive of the opposition to the military in Burma, but they changed in the mid-1990s, partly because they felt with Western sanctions, the net effect of all this of sanctions and isolation was that the Chinese were just filling in this vacuum. And they felt that the West could kind of afford that, perhaps, but as a near neighbor, it couldn't afford a Burma that was completely dominated by China. But they also saw in a more positive way that, you know, Burma could also be for them a bridge to the Far East and to markets in the Far East. But the big difference between India and China is that whereas China is now, for better or for worse, and through a lot of repression in the past, quite integrated, in India, the northeast of India, the part of India that borders on Burma, is home to literally hundreds of different languages, dozens of different minority groups, and has been the place where the Indian state has had to meet with dozens of different armed rebellions and insurgencies. And so it's been much harder for India to project its influence into Burma or its economic influence even in the way that China has.
So those ethnic groups and things are resisting Indian, what's the word I'm looking
state
for?
Control,
influence, yeah. Anything like that. So we talked about Burma being rich in natural resources. For instance, I mean, it's not just oil.
It's not just oil. It's oil and gas. It's all kinds of minerals, copper, lead. It has 95% of the jade in the world. At three jade auctions last year, they sold $6 billion worth of jade, they meaning Burmese businessmen as well as the Burmese government. It has almost any mineral, rare earth minerals, gold, silver, many things. And it's a relatively underpopulated country in the sense that it's one and a half times the size of France with 60 million people, relatively underpopulated for that region. And there's tremendous potential for it to grow actually much more in terms of its agricultural resources. So it has the two things that people want the most in the world right now, food and energy, and that both those and water. And both those things are important for India as well as for China.
So which the junta that's in control in Burma, which one does it favor, China or India? Or do they try to play one off the other?
Well, actually, the junta itself is gone. There were elections, widely condemned elections last year, but it led to a new constitutional setup. The old junta was dissolved, the old dictator retired, and there's a new quasi-civilian government in power. There's still a question mark over whether it's actually going to move in a solidly more democratic direction or something else. But in general, the military government in Burma has always been wary of China. These generals spent most of their careers fighting communist guerrillas that have been supported by China. Ideally, I think they would want a better relationship with the United States as well as for India and other countries. But they've always felt, through sanctions and other things, pushed into this relationship with China.
I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and we're talking with Thantmint Yu about his new book, Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. Now, Thant, wasn't Burma once part of British India? So doesn't it have more historic and cultural ties to India over China?
In many ways, yeah. I mean, they're very, very deep ties that go back literally thousands of years. Burma is a devoutly Buddhist country, and Buddhism, of course, is from India. Burma has always looked to India for cultural inspiration. You look at Burmese art, Burmese music, all of these things were to some extent influenced by India over the centuries. And yes, during the British period in the 19th and early 20th century, it was essentially just a province of India, and millions of Indians immigrated from India to Burma. Burma was seen, some Indians have said to me, as the first America. Like America today, it was a place where people went to remake their lives, for new opportunities, for jobs. Burma was then a much richer country than both India and China.
What are the prospects of the new government? Are we looking at a toddler democracy that trying to walk on wobbly legs, or are we looking at a toddler that's beginning to walk and on strong two legs thanks to the influences and investments coming from China and India?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think in some ways, if Burma gets its act together, if this new government really moves towards some kind of more representative government, improves its human rights situation, which allows then Western governments in the United States to end sanctions, it could develop enormously fast because of this potential, because of its strategic location. And that would have an enormous consequence on the entire region because it does border on this part of India that's been so isolated for so long. It borders on Bangladesh, which is another 160 million people. And then you would have this vibrant, young, economically very energetic democracy right next to or right up against the far interior of China. So it would remake the map. And if Burma became this crossroads, it would remake this map because India and China would be pressed up against each other or connected to each other in a way that they've never been before in all of history.
All of the money that we were talking about earlier on that's going into Burma, despite the sanctions, is that helping Burma and its new democracy? Is it helping it advance? Is that money going to the government, or is it somehow being siphoned off someplace else?
It's a huge question. I mean, it's a multi-billion-dollar question because up until now, under the old military junta, there's been zero transparency. So a lot of money, billions of dollars, had come in from oil contracts, natural gas contracts. It wasn't clear where the money was going, where it's been spent, if it's been siphoned off in some way. So whether or not this new government will introduce new transparency and we see exactly where the money is going, and if that money goes not into the hands of some private people but into the hands of the government that will then spend it on development projects and things, that will make a huge difference. So in the past, we don't really know. Now, with even more money coming in and set to come in, it's a huge question and will have a huge bearing on the nature of the government going forward.
One country we haven't even mentioned in all this is the United States. What does the United States make of all of this activity in Burma? And has the Obama administration been more engaged with Burma or less engaged with Burma than, say, his predecessor, President George W. Bush?
Well, Burma's not, as you can imagine, it's not a very high priority with all the other issues in the world, in Afghanistan, Iraq, in the Middle East, and everywhere else. The Obama administration came into office saying they wanted to review policy, and they have tried to engage with the government more than the Bush administration in the past. But again, it's a relatively low priority. The sanctions remain in place, and I've always argued for a very long time that these have been incredibly counterproductive. And in a way, what it's resulted in, because they're European sanctions as well as U.S. sanctions, is that Western influence in the country is at an all-time low. And it's very hard to see how that can really help in the longer term sort of democratic development in the country.
Well, when there was the junta, the relationships between Burma and the United States and the West was really bad. And you just said that the relation, or at least the view of the United States, is very low. Do you see a possibility of that relationship getting better, or is it going to be something where the United States, no matter who the president is, and the West, no matter who is in charge of all those governments, is they just turn their gaze either east to China or west to India?
Maybe in the future. I mean, it's not low in the sense, I mean, influence is low on the government. It's not low in the sense that people, ordinary people, don't feel still a connection to England as the old colonial power, to the United States, to Europe. I mean, most people still want to send their kids, if they can, to university in Australia or in the United States. You still see, people watch satellite TV, people watch American TV. All the movies that are showing in Burma are mostly Hollywood films. People watch American TV shows on satellite TV. So there is that influence. And, I think that there's every possibility in the next couple of years that things could turn around very fast in terms of connections. I mean, it's not as if Burma's ever been accused by the United States of being a country that's exporting terrorism or is causing problems elsewhere. It's essentially because America has tried to push a democracy agenda and has tried to promote democracy in a way that the old military junta didn't like. And if the country actually moves towards democracy, there's no reason why there couldn't be a very quick turnaround in terms of relations between the United States and Burma.
Well, you know, the State Department last year put out this statement on the elections that said the electoral process was severely flawed, precluded an inclusive, level playing field, and repressed fundamental freedoms. As a result, the elections were neither free nor fair. That's pretty tough to come from the State Department. How does that play itself out on the ground? I mean, you're going to have elections that aren't free or fair, but that doesn't mean that the people living under this new system are being repressed or as repressed as they were under the military junta. Is that an overly negative assessment of what happened?
It's difficult to say because the basic thing about the elections is that, or one basic thing about the elections is that they weren't monitored. There were no international monitors. So there were widespread allegations of fraud, especially in the big cities in Rangoon and Mandalay, where my guess is there was quite a lot of vote rigging. To what extent it happened in the rest of the country is hard to say. But it was a very choreographed process. And the main pro-democracy party led by Aung San Suu Kyi boycotted the election. So it was already very likely, even before the voting took place, that the pro-government, the pro-junta party was going to win. But the question this all kind of brings up is, you know, how do countries move from dictatorship to democracy? You know, is it in an Iraq style way where somebody has to invade and overthrow the, you know, the government and then you try to build it up in different ways? Or is it like in Burma? I mean, where, you know, is it possible that you have a dictatorship that begins to take some small steps towards opening up? And when a regime that's been as repressive and as isolated as Burma, when it starts to take even these first initial steps, do you still focus on the negative side, or do you try to encourage the very small steps that are taking place? So these elections were completely unfree and unfair, but we have moved from a junta military junta government to at least something that is more of a constitutional setup with a parliament and a presidency and civilians and everything else. Is that a first step that should be encouraged, or do we still focus on the negatives and say, it's still not good enough, and therefore we're going to keep sanctions and isolating you as well?
In terms of the United States and those sanctions, has the administration made any noises about doing away with them?
Not really. I mean, they've said in a very vague... I mean, they've said very clearly, I think, what they would like the Burmese government to do, one of which was to open a dialogue with one of the main opposition leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, which they have done. Another one is to release political prisoners, which they haven't done so far. Other things that they say would be important for the United States to improve relations, but they haven't really said then at what point sanctions might be relaxed or removed.
I'm speaking with Thant Mit Yeu about his new book, Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and we'll have more after the break. I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. I am pleased to continue the conversation with Thant Mit Yeu about his new book about China and India and what they're doing in Burma. And before we went to the break, you'd mentioned Aung San Suu Kyi, who was held under house arrest for years and years. Now she's 65 years old. What is her role in the new Burma, and is she held as high regard at home as we seem to have the impression here in the United States?
It's difficult to say, I guess, absolutely, because you know, there isn't any independent polling in Burma. She hasn't participated in an election since 1990, when her party won the overwhelming majority of seats in parliament. But anecdotally, when you go around, I was in Burma just a couple of weeks ago. When you travel around, I saw her actually just a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. as well. When you travel around Burma, when you meet people, when I meet my own relatives, I mean, it's clear, or it seems to be clear, that she's extremely popular. She's extremely popular. She's extremely influential.
How is she?
She seemed very upbeat to me. It was really just a personal visit. I hadn't seen her for a very long time. She met with the new president about a month ago, and I think that was very important. It was the new president was reaching out to her in that way, and they had begun a dialogue. Exactly. Because the military government hadn't spoken to her for, well, they had put her under house arrest, right. But they also hadn't spoken to her for such a long time. And that this new government was embarking on economic reforms, that was talking about the need to reduce poverty, was speaking honestly about the economic mess the country was in, was talking about corruption, and then had reached out to her as well and begun this dialogue. I think she didn't just say it to me, she said this publicly as well, that she feels that we may be at least at the beginning of a real transition, though it was too soon to draw any firm conclusions.
But she's hopeful. She's optimistic.
Yeah, she has said this herself publicly as well as to me, that she was hopeful that this was really the beginning of major change in the country.
And does she have any, I don't know, resentment towards the old regime, to the people who put her under house arrest? We've seen this in the past where people, their countries arrest them, detain them, and they come out and they have just this remarkable sense of, calm and peace and forgiveness. Does she have that?
I think so. I mean, who knows what, she might be feeling most deeply and privately, but, from what she has said to me and from others as well, I think she has always said that she wants political reconciliation and that she is not out to get anyone in terms of people in the past regime, and she has now said that with this government she's willing to cooperate in the national interest.
Does she want to be in politics? Does she want to be someone who helps run this new country, if you will?
I guess this is the big question for her, and it's a question also for the president and for this government, which is, does she see herself or continue to see herself as a leader of a political party that may seek public office, that may even run in a future election? Or does she see herself now as 65 and older later, more as a sort of elder stateswoman presiding over a democratic transition or transition to something better? I don't know, and I guess she may not fully know, depending on how the politics work out. I think the next few months will be critical in terms of determining whether or not the reforms really have legs in Burma and continue to move in the right direction, or whether we could see some sort of pullback or a loss of momentum. And I think she's also waiting to see exactly where things go as well.
What do you think she should do?
I think, to be honest, I think that she has this iconic position outside, and she has this very special role and this special respect inside. In a way, I would prefer her much more to be this elder statesperson, to help move the country along, to be this sort of moral voice at a time when so many things are changing in the country. I mean, all the things that we talked about before, the influence of China, the big projects, the environmental destruction, the problems that local communities are facing as a result of all this change, which has both positive and negative qualities. It's going to fuel corruption as well as maybe provide jobs and other things. And I think for her to be this very respected person who can speak in a moral voice about how the country needs to move forward and balance all of these things, I think that's something that she could do, and I think very few people other people in the country could do.
So don't go the Nelson Mandela route.
Well, I don't know. I'm not saying that for sure. But, it's also the case that we're not in the same position as South Africa when Nelson Mandela was released. It's not clear that, all of a sudden there's going to be democracy and that she's going to have the potential to play that specific role as in public office. But we'll see. I think, again, we're at an inflection point where I wouldn't have expected all the things happening now a year ago. And so who knows where we'll be a year from now.
And when you visited with her, what does she say about what's happening in terms of the influences and the attention being paid to Burma from China, from India?
We didn't really talk about that. I know that she has in the past said that she doesn't harbor any ill will towards China. She's not someone who's particularly worried about this huge increasing Chinese influence. But at the same time, she's also spoken out more recently against a specific dam project. There's a $3 billion massive Chinese dam that's being built at the headwaters of the Irrawaddy River, which is the biggest river in the country. And this has sparked the beginning of a real environmental protest movement in the country that has generated a lot of momentum just in the last few weeks with public protests. There's a new parliament which had been set up And actually, you've had the first real debates in Parliament on this issue. And if the government actually responds to public concern on this issue and her statements and other statements and actually suspends work on this dam, going against essentially a Chinese project that's been in the works for a while, that will also be a very important sign of where things might be going in terms of a government that might actually be responsive to public public demand.
Speak more specifically about the concerns about this dam. What are the concerns of the Burmese people?
Well, it's a number of things. One is it's in an area of the country, the far north of the country, where it's basically at the eastern end of the Himalayas. It's a huge mountainous region. Which is the home of a minority peoples called the Kachin, who actually fought with the Americans and the British during World War II against the Japanese in that very region. And this is their homeland, and it's going to flood an area about the size of Singapore, several times the size of Manhattan. Wow. And displace dozens of villages and thousands of people who live there. So that for the Kachins, it's a very emotive thing. For a lot of other Burmese people, the worry is also the downriver effects. The Irrawaddy basically waters a lot of the country. Literally tens of millions of people derive their livelihood from farming downriver from where the dam will be built. No one really knows exactly what the effects might be. And, I mean, perhaps most worryingly of all, you have this huge, massive dam being built on one of the biggest seismic fault lines in all of Eurasia. And I think at the very least, people want to know that studies have been done to verify that it won't have. In fact, Burma is a country that's very prone to earthquakes as well as cyclones and things. And so there are a number of different worries. And I think at the heart of it is just under the old military junta, a lack of transparency, a lack of consultation. So whether or not work can be suspended and you'll have at least a process of consultation on this issue, I think that will be a very important sign of the nature of this new government.
So the Chinese are investing in a dam on a fault line.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would the Chinese want to do that, you think?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the thing is, right next to Burma is the Chinese province of Yunnan, and that's about 45 million people. It's one of the poorest provinces in China. It's a province with 40% different ethnic minorities. And for the Communist Party in China, one of its key concerns has been to make sure that Yunnan develops to prevent unrest. And so for the longest time, anything that was good for Yunnan was good for Burma. So if Yunnan wanted to go in and build dams, if Yunnan wanted to go in and cut down all the forests in Burma, if Yunnan wanted to go in and buy mineral resources, whatever, if it was good for Yunnan's development, it was fine. And so there really wasn't this concern about what the collateral damage might be. It's only more recently where Beijing itself has become interested in Burma because of this backdoor access to the sea that we talked about earlier. That Beijing, I think, some people in Beijing are a little bit more concerned about a potential backlash, about how the Burmese people might be perceiving this Chinese economic push into the country. So I think on the one hand, you've had this push. On the other hand, it's only now the Chinese are a little bit more sensitive to the idea that the Burmese may not like everything that's going on.
I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, speaking with Thant Mit Nhu about his book, Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. So, Thant, should we be concerned by all the changes taking place in Burma, or should we welcome them?
Well, I think it should be both, in a way. I think that, you know, Asia is a place that is going to be increasingly, not decreasingly, important to America. I think it's important for Americans to understand that there is this basic geographic shift that is going on, that Burma is going to be in this increasingly central location, and that having a better government, having a democracy in Burma would be a great thing, and improving relations between America and Burma should be a great thing. But that means getting policy right. And I've always felt that this policy of sanctions and isolation was the wrong thing. And especially at this time when it looks like a new government's in power that may want to move in a more reform-oriented direction, I think it's all the more important to focus on this country to make sure that the American policies in place are the right ones.
As throughout this entire conversation, there's been a question just sort of nagging at me, and particularly with Chinese investment in China, I'm sorry, in Burma. Chinese interests are, it seems like, now supplanting the old colonial economic relationships. So are many of these countries including Burma, because the Chinese are major investments in, as you mentioned before, in Africa and Southeast Asia. Are they simply trading out one colonial relationship for another?
I guess that's the danger. And I think it's amplified in the Burmese case in a certain way. Because on the one hand, you know, some of these Chinese investments could be great. I mean, why not have a high-speed rail from Rangoon to Beijing? I mean, who else is going to invest $23 billion in infrastructure in your country? But, you know, on the other hand, there is this fear that, you know, with trade and investment comes this other kind of influence as well. And in Burma, it's especially difficult because you don't have those Western relationships. I mean, if Burma was a country that had a good relations with the United States and Europe, so there were American companies coming in, there were European companies coming in, and the Burmese could pick and choose and decide who they wanted to trade with, who they wanted to build this railway, who they wanted to build or give this mining concession to, that would be one thing. But because of sanctions from the West, there's no alternative but to turn to China, and which also means that they're not getting the best possible deals from China in terms of all these things. It's much easier for the Chinese to say, we're going to build this dam, and there are not going to be these environmental safeguards because there's nobody else who's going to come around and provide that kind of investment.
So the era of resisting globalization, is that over
in Burma? Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no turning back to the old days of the 60s and 70s when this was a little isolated country. And it's not just because of policy. It's also because populations have increased, not just in Burma, but next door in India and China. It's because, you know, this infrastructure is taking place. It's environmental change. I mean, it's in a way, it's a bad thing, but all these forests and jungles that used to be there have been cut down. So, I mean, this place is much more connected. So there's no way that the Burmese government can go back to this isolationist shell that was there before.
But is it as connected? Do lots of Burmese have cell phones and access to the internet and all of those things? This is part one of a two-part question.
Not really, but because it's so poor. So, I mean, you can buy a mobile phone. It's very expensive. It's extremely expensive, so many people can't afford it. I was in a little village, you know, a flight from Rangoon, several hours drive and several hours walk away. The village had no electricity, but they had a generator hooked up to a satellite dish, hooked up to a TV and satellite dish with a Indian Sky card, and they were watching British football, English football. So, I mean, people are connected, but not as much as in many neighboring countries, just because it's poor, not because they can't.
And so, so let's say in a few years, what's the anticipation of the kinds of changes that will happen in Burma when people have more access to cell phones and more access to the internet? I mean, we've just gone through the Arab Spring where we saw through Twitter and use of cell phones that entire revolutions can happen, just sort of generate among the people. Can that happen in Burma? Maybe not in that in that way, but could we see that kind of technological revolution?
I mean, my criticism of sanctions always was that what it was preventing was the development of this urban middle class that could be the basis for democratic change, even revolutionary democratic change. So I think if you just introduce more phones or internet connections, that in itself is not necessarily going to bring about or be a catalyst for those changes. Burma came very close to overthrowing the military government in 1988 before there were any of these things. So I think it's more about the relationship between ordinary people and the government than technology. But, you know, I think what can happen is that with all these changes, you can either have a very ugly picture emerging, where Burma becomes this crossroads, but, you know, there remain all these unfinished armed conflicts, ethnic conflicts. Burma becomes still a place of drug trafficking, of heroin and other drug production. It feeds lots of other problems into India and China and Thailand with refugees and other things. But the alternative is this wonderful scenario where, you know, again, Burma gets its act together, becomes a more democratic country, and it becomes this crossroads, because the part of India and China that are connected to Burma are very special parts of both countries. When we think of India and China, we think of them in a certain way. But these parts of India and China that I've traveled to, they're the mountainous bits of both countries where literally hundreds of different ethnic minority peoples live, cultures, languages. And if all of those places opened up in a different way, you would see a very different region, not just Burma again, but India and China as well.
One-word answer. Optimistic or pessimistic about Burma's future?
I'm optimistic for the first time in a while.
I've been speaking with Thant Minh Nhu about his book, Where China Meets India, Burma and the New Crossroads of Asia. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks.